book of Nehemiah. We're going to begin looking at that book this evening. Even though Nehemiah is in the Old Testament, I think there are some powerful lessons from Nehemiah that particularly for those who are in leadership positions in the church, those who want to do something to lead, help lead, Nehemiah is a good example to look at. There are also some powerful lessons in Nehemiah about just what happens when we work together. And we're going to look at some of those as we begin that book tonight. We won't finish it. It has 13 chapters. We won't finish that tonight, but we'll try to get as many in as we can without running too long. So I begin in chapter 1, go down to verse 4, will be our first verse. Now Nehemiah is at the same time period as Ezra. This is, remember, the Jews had gone off into captivity at the end of 2 Kings and at the end of 2 Chronicles, because those two books cover pretty much the same period of time. So at the end of that time, after the last king, the Jews from Judah had been taken into Babylonian captivity. Jeremiah and Isaiah had prophesied that they were going to have to stay in that captivity for 70 years. And so now we're at the end of that 70 years, and the Jews are getting to return back home to Jerusalem, back to Judea, back to Judah. And Nehemiah is one of those that gets to come back. Now Nehemiah is not anyone of great consequence in the land of captivity. He's a servant to the king. He was the king's cupbearer. That was his job, was to basically drink whatever there was in the cup before the king drank it to make sure that the king didn't get poisoned. So you know how highly they thought of this individual. This is the individual who is completely expendable, completely useless. If he dies, no big deal. That's who Nehemiah was. He was a slave, a servant to the king. And all he did, his job was to drink whatever the king was going to get. To make sure that if it was poison, he died, and so the king would know not to drink it. Not a fun job, but that's Nehemiah's job. And that's what he's involved with. And here, though, we have the story, then, of Nehemiah, who becomes, even from such a low position, a great leader of the Jewish people. And that goes to show us as well how you don't have to be born into a position of greatness. And it doesn't have anything to do with your birthright. I remember in the old Robin Hood movie, someone asked Robin Hood about royalty or something of that sort. And he said he had seen princes run when the battle got difficult, and he had seen servants stand and fight to the death. And it's true that nobility, courage, those things don't come by birth. You're not born with nobility. You're not born courageous. Those are things that you have to develop within yourself, like we were talking about this morning. And Nehemiah managed to develop some of those characteristics that make a good leader. And because of that, he becomes one of the best leaders in actuality that Israel ever had. He would be comparable to David or Joshua, because he does some things and he gets the people back doing what God wants them to do in a way that there are times where it said they had not done such and such in this way as they were supposed to since the days of Joshua. That's how long. All those kings, even David, Hezekiah, Josiah, all those, even the good kings, even through their time period, they didn't do things according to the way God wanted it to be done, according to the law of Moses, like they did when Nehemiah was ruling and in charge of things, and getting the people to do what was right. Notice verse 4 then, chapter 1. And it came to pass, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept, and mourned certain days, and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Now here's what he's crying about. Verse 3 tells us, they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and the gates are burned with fire. So that's what he's upset about. This holy city of Jerusalem, the city that God had said, I will put my name there. And where God had his temple built, that city's been destroyed. The walls have been broken down. The temple was destroyed and ruined. The gates had been burned. And Nehemiah, when he hears this, he sat down and wept. This is the first great characteristic of a good leader. Someone who's not afraid to show the deep emotion that they have. Nehemiah wasn't afraid for people to see him weep over the condition of God's city. And today in the church, sometimes I think too many of the leaders in the Lord's church don't care when they see the spiritual walls of the city broken down and burned with fire. And they don't care. It's no big deal to them. But to me, Nehemiah was a big deal. And we need to have that kind of conviction that tells us that when we see the city of God, which today is the church wherever it is, when we see these problems occurring, it needs to affect us deeply. It needs to move us, even to tears. Nehemiah sat down and wept, and he mourned for days. Notice what else he did. He fasted, and he prayed before the God of heaven. And he wanted to focus on spiritual things. And to that end, he just neglected his physical needs for a period of time. He didn't feed himself. He said, I'm going to worry about the spirit thing. He prayed and he mourned over this situation. He didn't eat. Then we look to chapter 2. Artaxerxes is the king. And here in verse 1 is where we see that Nehemiah was his cupbearer. He would bring him his wine. And he would have to taste everything to make sure it wasn't poison. But in verses 4 and 5, I want us to notice verse 4 in particularly. Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? So the king asked Nehemiah a question. And when the king asks you a question, you answer it real quick. Because he's not going to sit around and wait all day for the answer. But notice what Nehemiah does first. He says, what's your request? The king said. Nehemiah says, so I pray to the God of heaven. Now this tells us something. Prayer doesn't have to be long and drawn out. It doesn't have to last 5 minutes. It doesn't have to last all night like Jesus prayed for hours. You know, it doesn't have to be that way though. Sometimes it can happen in a matter of moments, in just a few short seconds. Because obviously he's not going to keep the king waiting. Wait a minute, king, while I go over here and pray for 30 minutes. No, he's going to just say a quick prayer to God in his mind. He's not going to speak it out loud if he doesn't want the king praying in front of the king like that. So it's going to be just between him and God. He prayed to the God of heaven. This is where we see that a prayer does not have to be spoken out loud either. He's not going to say that prayer out loud right there in front of the king. He's going to just quickly ask God for strength, for courage, to ask what needs to be asked. And then we see in verse 5, I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant hath found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. So he asked the king, can I go back to my home and rebuild that city? It takes a lot of courage sometimes to ask some of those things. It's a difficult thing because the king could have very easily said, no, you've got to stay here. You're my servant. You've got to stay here. And even worse, the king could have thought of him as a traitor for wanting to leave and could have had him put to death, any number of things. But he didn't. He recognized how important a thing this was. And so he grants Nehemiah's request. And Nehemiah then comes to Jerusalem. Now let's notice also here in chapter 2, verse number 15. Once Nehemiah gets to Jerusalem, really from verses 13 on, really from verse 12 and on, but just verse 15 says, and I went up in the night by the brook and viewed the wall and turned back and entered by the gate of the valley and so returned. So he went and looked at the situation. There's another good example of what good leadership does. Examine the situation. See what's needed. See what needs to be done. See how good or how bad the situation really is. Sometimes a situation is so bad, you know, here, the wall may have been so bad they said, we'll just have to start over. Other times, other places, the wall might have been in a condition where it could just be repaired. So he had to make that decision. He had to view the situation and see where they stood. And so he did that. And he did that by night. He didn't want to make a big show out of it. He just wanted to examine the situation and figure out what was going on. Then, verse 18, he begins to get the other people involved. It's always best, before you try to lead somebody somewhere, that you have a plan for where you're going. Or you say, well, let's all go to California, let's all go jump in the car and take off, and we don't know where we're going, and we don't have a map, and we wind up in Canada instead, or Mexico. We've got to have a plan for where we're going. And that's one of the things that leadership has to do, is develop a plan and know where we're going. Chris and I were talking, I guess it was last evening, and we were talking about being a good leader. We're talking about the fact that you can't lead somebody somewhere unless that's where you're going, too. Nehemiah couldn't just tell the people, here, y'all do this. He was going to have to be involved. He had to take a role in it. And that's the difference between leadership in the church, which is what Jesus instructed his apostles and his disciples to have, the kind of leadership that leads by example. We always say, we sing that song, where he leads, I will follow. Well, the same thing is true with human leadership. Where they lead is where we can follow. We can't follow them if they're not leading in the right direction. Nehemiah was leading in the right direction. We saw Jesus tell his apostles that you're not supposed to rule like the Gentiles rule. The Gentiles king lorded it over them. They would tell them, okay, you go out and fight the battle. And then you come back and tell me what you've done. But Jesus said, no, that's not the way it's supposed to be. The leaders have to be out in front if they're going to lead. And Nehemiah was that kind of a leader. He was involved from the very start. He made the plan, he knew what needed to be done, and then he got the people fired up to do what needed to be done. Look at verse 18. Then I told them of the hand of my God which was good upon me, as also the king's word that he had spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. You see, when you just say, well, let's do something, everybody says, well, what do you want to do? Well, I don't know. What do you want to do? Well, I don't know. Let's do something. You don't get very far that way. But when somebody comes in with a plan, like Nehemiah had said, here's what we need to do. I've already got God. We know God's for it. God wants the city rebuilt. I've talked to the king. The king's behind it. He wants to let us rebuild the city. And so now, let's get to work. And so then the people were ready to go then, and they started to strengthen their hands. They were ready to get involved. But verse 19 carries with it one of the things that is inevitable, even with good leadership. But one of those things that good leadership can survive that poor leadership can't. It's inevitable in every situation when you're trying to do something good, when you're trying to build it up, when you're trying to work on something, trying to help the situation out, it's inevitable that this is going to be happening. Notice verse 19. But when Sanballat the Horonite, notice he's not an Israelite, he's not part of their group, and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, notice he's not an Israelite either, and Jeshem the Arabian, notice he's not an Israelite either. Now sometimes these people may be masquerading as part of the group, but these guys, they're not part of the group. They're not part of the ones that want to do this thing. Notice what they do. When they heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that you do? Will you rebel against the king? Now see, Nehemiah knew they weren't rebelling against the king, because Nehemiah had asked the king's permission to rebuild the city. And the king had granted it to him and told him to go ahead and go and do it. But these two, oh, you're rebelling against the king, you're rebuilding this city. This is the case. No matter what good thing you're trying to do, there's always going to be somebody there trying to stop it and tear it down. when we were at the ocean last week, and we were trying, Xander didn't want to, the waves were pretty rough, and Xander didn't want to get out there in those big waves or anything. He was scared whenever the water would come up, he'd run the other way. And so we dug out an area there where the waves would come up and fill him a little pool, and we were digging out an area there. And as we were digging it out, he was standing in the pool area where we had cleared it. He was standing in the pool area knocking the walls down. And there were three of us, myself and my dad and Don. We were all trying to build up those walls, all three of us. And that one little guy right there was tearing them down faster than the three of us could put them up. It's a lot easier to tear things down than it is to build things up. And good leadership has to be prepared for the fact that there are going to be people that are going to try to tear things down. Not just the leadership, but everybody that's involved, we have to know there are going to be some people who aren't going to want good things to happen, and they're going to try to stop it. Now, some of those people may be outside the church. Sometimes, unfortunately, some of those people are in the church. And I'll tell you what, the ones that are in the church can be a lot more destructive than the ones outside the church. Because they tear it down from the inside out. But we've got to be prepared for that. We've got to know that it's coming, expect it, and have a game plan. We've got to know that we're all on the same side. We're all trying to do the right thing, and we're not going to let them discourage us. Notice here what they said. They said they laughed at us, they despised us, and they said, what, are you rebelling against the king? Now, Nehemiah, see, had already taken care of this, because in the verse previous, he had told the people, God's with us, and the king is with us. They'd already taken care of this. The only thing left was these people were mocking him. They were despising him. They were laughing at him. That can be very discouraging at times. And so these people needed to have that strength and that courage to endure the ridicule. We face ridicule too sometimes, don't we, as Christians? You bet we do. We're going to face some ridicule. Because not everybody thinks that what we're doing is a good idea. We got a letter, I don't know when it came, but we got it yesterday, from someone who, apparently they somehow got a hold of one of our house-to-house, heart-to-heart letters. We didn't mail it to them. They must have gotten it from someone handed it to someone who handed it to someone. They're from Louisiana. And we got a letter from this person that just was, oh, your church is horrible, and you say these things, but you don't do what the Bible says, and just on and on. About what, you know, how horrible it is. And told us that we needed to repent and get right with God. They don't even know who we are. They don't have any idea of what we teach or what we practice, but they already know that we're bad. That we're all doomed because of what we are. They don't have any idea. And that's the way it is many times when people are trying to undermine a good work. They don't even know what they're talking about. These guys didn't know what they were talking about. Oh, you're trying to rebel against the king. They didn't know what they were talking about. But they were still saying it. And it can still disturb people and discourage the work. And that's exactly what they were trying to do. They were trying to discourage the work. But it didn't succeed because there were some good people involved. Notice chapter 3 and verse number 1. Even after this, even after Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem tried to mess things up. Verse 1 of chapter 3 says, then Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brethren the priests, and they builded the chief gate. They sanctified it and set up the doors of it. Even unto the tower of Mia they sanctified it, unto the tower of Hananiel. So that the high priest and his family members, his brethren, the priests, they said, we don't care what these guys say, we're going to do what's right. And they started building. And if you want to look, you can look then through the rest of chapter 3. It's going to just say, and next to them, these people started building, and next to them, these people built, and next to them, these people built, and next to them, these people built. You see, all it takes is one person starting out doing what's right, setting the proper example for other people to fall in line and follow that good example. Well, the same thing works with a bad example, too, however. But in this case, they set the good example. They started work despite the ridicule, despite the laughter and the mocking and the threat and the accusation. They started working, and everybody else followed suit. Notice in that chapter, Eliashib and his brothers, the priests, they didn't have to build the whole wall. They just built their section of it. And then next to them, some other people started building. And on and on. We used to sing a song at camp. It said, it only takes a spark to get a fire going. I don't know if y'all have ever heard that song. Beautiful song. Really great song to sing around a campfire at night up in the mountains somewhere or something. But it's so true. Just one little spark gets that fire going. And I think the song says, and soon all those around can warm up to its glowing. Now, on a hot summer day like today, we don't think much about wanting to warm up to a fire. But we used to go to a camp up in South Dakota in the Black Hills, which were really mountains. They were pretty big for hills. And at night, we'd have a campfire devotional before we'd go to bed at that camp. And by the time we'd have that devotional, it'd be 10:30 or so at night, and it would be already down into the 40s. And that fire felt good when it got going. And that's how it is. I think the song says that's how it is with God's love. Once you've experienced it, you want to spread his love to everyone, I think is kind of the way it goes. There's several verses there, and they each mention different things. But isn't that true? That just one little spark gets something started. We think about the church in this community. It got started with one little spark somewhere. And it built up, it built up. I don't know that we could call it a raging fire now. It's certainly not a wildfire, but we've got a good fire going. We've just got to keep that fire going and keep it growing. And throw on some more kindling, so to speak. In a good way, not in a bad way. We don't want to throw anybody to the fire in any bad sense. But all through the 32 verses of chapter 3, just one after the other, who was building. And they had enough people that they were building all the way around the city. Building that wall back up to defend the city. We'll finish chapter 4 and then we'll be through. Chapter 4, of course, when people try to oppose you, they expect that it's going to work. They think it's going to stop everything right there. And when they can't succeed, they start to get angry. And Sanballat got angry. Verse 1, when Sanballat heard that we built the wall, he was wroth, or he was angry, and took great indignation and mocked the Jews. And he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, what do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish which are burned? Now Tobiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, even that which they build, if a fox goes up, he shall even break down their stone wall. Well, you know, a fox is a pretty small animal. And it's not a very sturdy wall if a fox is going to break it down. Now, you know, if you just said an elephant and break it down, well, you know, but a fox, if a little fox runs up there on it, it's going to fall down again. That's how they were mocking them. They were making fun of them, trying to discourage the work. Notice what happens, though, in verse 7. But it came to pass. Notice the people didn't stop working. They kept working right through the ridicule, right through that mocking. They kept on going. When it came to pass, that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped, then they were very wroth. So first, you know, they just kind of got frustrated and angry and said, well, you know, we tried to stop it, it didn't work. And so we'll try something else. And now they're seeing that the work's getting accomplished. And they're starting to get very angry about it. Notice verse 8. And conspired all of them together. Notice who that is. That's Sanballat, the Samaritan, Tobiah, the Arabians, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites. Basically three or four nations of people conspiring together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. And Jerusalem is just one city. And it's not like they had a big wall ready to defend themselves. They were trying to build the wall still. There were still holes in their defense system. And they were trying to work, and these people were going to come and fight against them. That's a very dangerous time. It's a time when people are very easily destroyed. Remember what Jesus said in the parable of the sower? Some of the seed was cast on the rocky ground, it sprang up, but then because it didn't have enough root. There was trouble. The sun came out and scorched it, and it died. Some sprang up in the thorny ground, and it got choked out by the thorn. Well, the same thing is true with Christian work. When we get new converts in, we've got to get work to get them grounded. But during the time where they're not yet solidly grounded, not well rooted in the faith, that's the time when Satan is going to try to attack the hardest, because he knows their roots aren't deep yet. He can get them right then still. And so he doesn't try to attack the elders who've been members of the church for 20 and 30 years. He doesn't try to attack them. He tries to attack those new converts. He tries to attack the young people who are just leaving home, going off to college, or starting a new life. He attacks those that he considers to be weak, and he tries to drag them away. He works just like a lion or like a wolf would with a flock of sheep. Whenever there's a flock of sheep or a herd of animals and some predator is coming toward that group, they don't go after the strongest one. They go after the one that's weak, the one that's sick, the one that's old or crippled in some way. That's the one they go after. The musk ox, I believe it is, are some of the most amazing animals. When they're attacked by the Arctic wolves, they circle themselves around the young and around the weak. All of the adults circle around, and they keep their horns pointed out. They trust the people on the other, well, not people, they're musk ox, but they trust those ox on the other side of that circle. They never, it doesn't matter, the wolf goes out of their sight that way, they don't worry about it. They only worry about what they can see. They trust whoever's on the other side to cover their back. Same way with soldiers in a battle. They've got to trust each other. You can't constantly be looking everywhere. You've got to trust the people you're in battle with. And as Christians, when we're in battle, we've got to trust one another. We've got to be able to defend our area and trust our fellow Christians to defend their area. We've got to work together to do it, because one can't do it alone. Notice chapter 9, verse 9 then of chapter 4. Nevertheless, we made our prayer unto our God and set a watch against them day and night because of them. You notice what Nehemiah does. The first thing he does is he prays. Prayer is one of the most useful tools that we can possibly have. It's one of the greatest weapons we have against sin and evil and against Satan. But he didn't just pray for God to take them out of the way. He also, we see, set a watch. He set some people up to watch and make sure that they weren't coming. And then he went even further than that. Verses 16 through 18, look what he did. It came to pass from that time forth that half of my servants wrought in the work, in other words, half of them were working, and the other half of them held both the spears, the shields, and the bows, and the haberjons. And the rulers were behind all the house of Judah. They which built it on the wall, and they that bear burdens, and those that laid it, every one with one of his hands he did the work, and with the other hand he held the weapon. Now, you might think, well, you'd never get any work done that way. But you could. It might not go as fast, but you'd be prepared to defend yourself. And so that's what Nehemiah has them do. They're working with one hand and ready to fight with the other. They've got their weapon. And he says, for the builders, everyone had his sword girded by his side, and so he built it. And he that sounded the trumpet was by me. So they had the watch set. He was right there by the guy that had the trumpet, and they were watching. And they had all of the people building on the wall all around the city, ready to go to fight as soon as they heard that trumpet sound, if there was an attack. Sometimes we don't do that, though, do we, in the church? We don't worry about it. The devil comes and takes one away, and 3 or 4 months later, we go to see why that individual left the church. As soon as we see the attack, we need to be called to that trumpet sound. Whoever sees that happening, seeing somebody being taken back into the world and drawn out of the church by Satan, sound the alarm and let everybody rush to assist, to try to help that individual. Now, it's true that even under those circumstances, we may still lose some. But we've got to do everything we can to avoid losing any more than absolutely is necessary. We know that Jesus, even as great as he was, lost Judas, didn't he? We're going to lose some sometimes to the devil. But we've got to be sure that we've done everything we can to keep that from happening. Jesus did everything he could to try to keep Judas from going bad. But he couldn't stop it. Judas had free will. He went bad of his own accord. Followed his own lust and got involved in sin, and that sin led to his death, just like James said it would. We've got to be prepared, though, to do everything possible to stop that from happening. We see, can't we, that Nehemiah was a great leader. He had a plan, he was prepared, and he was able to get the people mobilized and get them working. What a leader he was. And we see the people working together. You notice it doesn't say anything about some people sitting around griping about how other people were doing their section of the wall. They were too busy working on their section of the wall to have time to worry about how everybody else was doing their section of the wall. Sometimes we want to be inspectors instead of workers. We need to be busy working for God and spend our time working. But if there's danger, we need to be ready to sound the alarm. If you're here tonight, you haven't need to respond to the invitation. Perhaps you've been more like Sanballat and his friends and actually been trying to hinder the work instead of help it. That's something that the church doesn't need. The church doesn't need any Sanballats. Don't need any of those guys at all. Try to get things right in your life. Turn things around. Make the determination that you're not going to hinder the work anymore, but you're going to help it grow. Help it do better in the future. If you're here tonight, you're not a Christian, and there's no better time to become a Christian than now. There may be no other time than now. If you're here and you have a need to respond to the invitation for whatever reason, we ask you to do so as we stand and understand.